This episode of Walking the Floor is made possible with support from Fender Play. Have you or someone you know been looking to learn how to play the guitar? Well, my friends over at Fender recently introduced Fender Play, the complete learning platform from the most trusted name in guitar, offering on-demand guitar lessons through a video-based platform that's designed to help you play your favorite songs and learn key skills in minutes. For your free trial of Fender Play, please visit Fender.com/walking the floor.
Hey, this is Don Landis. You're listening to Walking the Floor.
I'm walking the floor over you.
Walking the floor.
I'm walking the floor.
Walking the floor over you.
Hola, senores and senoritas. This is Chris Shiflett, and you're listening to Walking the Floor. I hope everybody out there in podcast land is surviving and doing okay. It's been a really rough week of insane levels of tragedy here in Southern California. What with that shooting last week in Thousand Oaks, and then of course all the wildfires raging all over the state, and of course, what natural disaster would be complete without an offensive, misinformed, ignorant tweet from Mr. President Trump? And this week was no exception. If you missed that, I suggest you go Google it. President Trump continues to be an absurd embarrassment, and let's all hope that that's his undoing sooner than later. Anyway, I had a great time last weekend rambling around Texas, opening up for my buddy Paul Cawthon. You know, if you haven't seen Paul Cawthon play live, I highly recommend it. The man is a force to be reckoned with, man. He's a talented mofo, and he's got a big old voice that just fills the room. And his whole band and crew are just about the nicest guys I've been on tour with in a while, man. They made me feel right at home, and it was a lot of fun. Can't wait to do some more shows with him this coming weekend. By the time you hear this, I will have already been back to Texas to do more shows in Austin and New Braunfels with Mr. Paul. And if Houston and Dallas were any indication, they're going to be a real hoot. And also, I got to open up for Dale Watson while I was down there at this classical dance hall outside of San Antonio called Floor's Country Store. I guess it used to be like a hangout for Willie Nelson. It was super cool. And a little nerve-wracking because it was really like a room full of cowboys that came to two-step. And I was up there, just a man and his acoustic guitar, no rhythm section. So I was a little nervous going into it, but it turned out to be great. And I even signed some old cowboy's hat. So there you go. Good times. Good times in Texas. And again, just want to throw a big thanks out to Fender Play for helping to make this episode of Walking the Floor absolutely free. Fender Play is the complete learning platform for the most trusted name in guitar. Available on desktop and mobile, so you can learn anytime, anywhere. It's the quickest and easiest way to learn how to play guitar, bass, or ukulele with bite-sized video lessons featuring hundreds of top songs and classic favorites. So get on over there and get your honky-tonk on, or your rock and roll, or your pop, or whatever genre you're into. They got something to serve your needs. For your free trial of Fender Play, please visit Fender.com/walking the floor. And support for Walking the Floor also comes from D'Addario. D'Addario, a fine maker of USA-made instrument strings and musical accessories, is committed to sustainability through the Playback Program, recycling over 1 million used instrument strings. For more information on the Playback Program and how to help in its mission of reaching 2.5 million strings in 2018, please visit playback.daddario.com. And last but not least, our good friends over at Zounds.com, where every order of $599 and above is eligible for their exclusive 12-part payment plan with no application processed, no interest charged, ever. And you just pay that first monthly installment and your gear ships immediately. Zounds.com. Check them out. All right, let's get on over to the interview. Okay, so my interview today is with the wonderful Don Landis. caught up with her recently when she was out west doing promo and setting up her latest record, which is called Meet Me at the River. It's out now. Go check it out. I gotta say, I didn't even really remember until I listened back to this to put this together for release that there was construction going on outside of my studio the day that she was here. And it's kind of noisy. There's a lot of like skill saws buzzing in the background, but bear with me because it's a good interview. We talk about influences and songwriting and growing up and living all over from like Louisville to Branson to New York City to Nashville to getting into like production on the other side, you know, working on other people's records and stuff. Even she recorded when I think it was her first record, wound up getting released in France, and she toured over there and has some funny stuff to say about that. But we start off with her talking about making her latest record with the legendary producer Fred Foster, who was the guy that brought the World Monument Records and all the incredible artists associated with that. I think she pulled him out of retirement to get him to do this, and that's where we start off right here with Dawn Landis on Walking the Floor. Highway calling me. Okay. I mean, first things first, I just gotta know how you got Fred Foster out of retirement to do your new record. Tell that story. And also talk a little bit about, because probably a lot of people listening don't know who Fred Foster is.
Sure.
Or what that means to pull a guy like that out mm-hmm. of retirement.
Well, I knew I wanted to make a record in Nashville, and I wanted to work with someone who had worked on some of the albums that I love, like some of the older albums. I'm a huge Skeeter Davis fan, and obviously Chet Atkins is gone, so he wasn't possible. But, and Fred's name came up. I actually asked Larry Crane from Tape Op, who's a friend of mine. I said, "Hey, Larry, who's in Nashville that's still making records that was around back in those days?" And he had just interviewed Fred for Tape Op. And then he said, "Well, I'm not sure if he'd be interested," but then he put me in touch with Kyle Lenning, who ended up working on the album too. And then Kyle said, "Well, I don't know, good luck, you know, here's his number." So I called him.
Really? So
on the
you
phone.
Just cold called him? Like out of
I
the,
called him on the phone. Hey, I was
and
so
had
nervous.
No sort of past with him at
nope,
all? No introduction?
Nothing. No, he was like, "Who are you and how did you get my phone number?"
But he was open to it.
Yeah, I mean, he was skeptical, you know, but he had me, you know, it was all very slow process because he doesn't email. So, and he doesn't have an assistant or anything. So it was all like actually sending him stuff in the mail, calling him on the phone to follow up. Then eventually I went to his house.
Sending him like song ideas and that sort of thing. Is that?
Well, the first thing he said was, you know, "Send me some of your music," because he had never heard of me, obviously. And "Send me some of your music. Send me some demos of songs you want to work on, and I'll see I'll see if I have anything to contribute." That's how he phrased it.
Because he's not just a legendary producer, he also wrote songs, right? I mean, isn't he a songwriter?
You know,
and of course,
yes,
Monument
he is.
Records. It was
of course,
his thing.
Yeah. So if you're not familiar with Fred, he was the brains and the brawn behind Monument Records, and they put out such a diverse roster of artists. Like, they did Dolly Parton's first record and all the Roy Orbison hits, but he also was a publisher, so he signed Christofferson to his publishing deal. Then he produced his albums, and then he promoted them. So it was like a one-stop shop. Like,
right.
He did everything for those guys. He took the picture on Dolly Parton's first record.
Really?
He wrote the liner notes. Like, he was the guy.
Wow. He was hands-on.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. He was handsy. No, just kidding.
And not just him. It's like the musicians are older session cats as well,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah.
Because a lot of those guys are still in Nashville, but like I'm guessing they probably don't get like a lot of phone calls to work on like current stuff.
Oh, I don't know if that's true.
Oh, really?
I think they work a lot, but they're they're more selective about what they do.
Right.
I mean, Larry Paxton was the band leader for the sessions, and he plays every night at the Opry. Like, he's the band leader at the Opry. And Steve Gibson was, I think, he also plays at the Opry every once in a while, but I kind of think they're more choosy now.
Well, talk about what that process was in the studio, because I know from my own personal experience of sort of being in situations with like legends and people who you are a huge fan of, mm-hmm. you know, sometimes that can be awkward because a lot of times people don't want to sort of do the thing that you love them for from the record in 1965. They're on to something completely different.
Sure.
And there's also that thing of like, you're a fan and you don't want to like you know, you don't want to like correct some legendary player. Not correct, but you know what I mean? It's like, it's hard to put things in the suggestion box sometimes. And so that can be an awkward process. Did you have any of that with these guys or with Fred?
I think, or
did you get over that quick?
I got over it. It took a while to get over it, but we did so much pre-production work. Like he called it woodshedding. I would go to his house and we would sit there and just look, like analyze the lyrics and talk about the song and does it make sense? And this needs work and this isn't working. And like, go back to the drawing board with this. That happened so much that initially, like, I felt, I don't know, it was sort of humiliating, but also liberating, you know?
Right.
It was like, okay, fine. Yeah, here we go. So then that process took a long time. And then in the meantime, you know, he told me a gazillion stories. We listened to a ton of music and I felt like I was kind of going to school a little bit with him, which is amazing. I feel really lucky. I really do. Yeah, I do.
Making.
Yeah.
Like what going into something like that, what is your songwriting process? You know, when it's just you just sitting there, you're getting everything together to go present to your producer, whoever it is you're working
with. I had never really worked with a producer in that way. Like I'm an engineer. I had a studio in Brooklyn. Like I've produced other people's records. Like I normally had a much more production role in my albums. I mean, the last one I worked with my friend Thomas Bartlett, but he was a good friend of mine. So it was like a different relationship.
Right.
So I'd never really done that before. So I just did it as it came, as the muse came, and just there was the song and pretty much not much editing.
But generally speaking with your songwriting, like, do you do a lot of co-writes? What's kind of your way of doing things?
Right. Well, I hadn't really before until this album. But
are you living in Nashville now?
I am.
You are? Okay.
Yeah.
And you were in New York for a long time.
I was, right? Yeah. Okay. So in New York, I mostly wrote all my own stuff. And then, you know, I played in some other people's projects, and then I had a girl band with two friends and we co-wrote songs together, but it was all in a style, like a Ronettes kind of style. And I made a French album and I co-wrote some songs.
A French album?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, really? Wow.
I lived in France for a little while and okay. Just got obsessed with the language and I felt like I needed help. Not to sound like an idiot.
It must be so great to live in France and actually speak French, because having toured through France and traveled on vacation through France a lot, that is an exceptionally difficult place to not speak the
language. It is, and that's why I learned it out of necessity, because my very first albums came out on French labels. So I was touring over there and I didn't speak the language at all. And all the musicians were French people and the audience, you know, they would come up.
You had to learn it.
Yeah, I remember they would come up to me after a show and say, "It was funny." And I was like, "Wait, my songs are sad. How is it funny?"
That's just striking the wrong nerve.
Right.
Before we move on, but from the new one, like, what would be? Is there any one? I know these are kind of like lame questions to ask, but I got to ask. But like, was there one kind of moment of sage advice or wisdom, or you know, the pearls of wisdom from Fred Foster that that stick out from those recording sessions?
Honestly, I feel like I learned more in the woodshedding process with him, just because we talked about music so much. The sessions themselves were so condensed and so quick. Like, that's how they used to work back in the day. You know, 3 hours, get three songs done.
Right.
And, you know, the arrangements happened so fast. I feel like, gosh, I learned so much from him.
Like, what were some of the artists that he turned you on to?
Well, I mean, pretty much all the Monument catalog. And it's funny, I was just yesterday making a playlist in Spotify of like some of the Monument artists, like some of Fred's favorites I mean, Charlie McCoy, obviously, who played on the record, some of his own recordings are great. And Boots Randolph, the sax player.
Okay.
Jimmy Driftwood, who I ended up covering some of his songs on the album. And he was like a folk singer from Arkansas.
Do you have a folky past? Like, is folk music a big influence of yours? Because I hear that in your music.
Yeah. What does that mean exactly?
Well, I mean, past? Like, did you grow up listening to like folk music? You know.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't. It's funny. My parents listened to the radio.
Okay.
You know. Where'd
you grow up?
In Louisville, Kentucky. But I was born I grew up in Indiana, Missouri, and Kentucky. But Kentucky is where I call home because I know people that live there still, and I learned to drive there, and I know where everything is, you know.
Right. It's the home of Muhammad Ali.
Is it not? Yeah. It is.
And
indeed.
The Louisville Slugger.
That's right.
I have one of those with my name
do
on it.
Do you? Yeah. Did you go to the factory?
It's a cool tour. I want to say it was like a present from a promoter a long time ago.
It's a cool tour.
I keep it by my bed just in case. That's great. That's my home security program. Okay, so you grew up mostly in Louisville. Mm-hmm. Like, what were your early musical memories? Like, what got you into music?
I danced. I was a ballet dancer when I was a kid, and so I was really exposed to like all this classical music and stuff. So I remember loving Switched on Bach. Which is not, I mean, because I liked...
Not very honky-tonk.
It is not. But, I mean, you know, because we did a dance piece to that, and that was, I was just around that music all the time. It was, and, you know, when you're performing in a dance piece, you listen to something over and over and over again, and I think maybe later in life, that's why I was able to mix a song for 3 days and not get bored by it, because I was used to that repetition that you get when you're dancing or something. I don't know. I mean, this was when I was really young. So.
And when did you start playing? I mean, what came first? Singing, guitar playing?
Singing for sure. I mean, I sang in choirs and stuff like that. And I mean, I sang in church and things like that. But yeah, I mean, that's where I learned to harmonize, I think, just like looking in a hymnal and stuff like that.
When did you figure out like, oh, I want to go perform. I want to be a performer. Did you have like early band attempts in high school?
Oh yeah. Sort of I had a girl rock band called Cookie Cutter Wet Dream Fantasy after something Courtney Love said in an interview. I thought that was cool.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. We played one show and the drummer like scooted all over the stage because we didn't realize you had to have a rug.
Hey, that's how you learn those lessons, kids. That's funny. I don't know if it was like it for you in high school, but I think we had more bands that we talked about than we actually did. We're going to call it Vatos from Hell, and it's going to be me and you and this guy and that. And then you'd never actually write a song or perform or rehearse or anything, but you just sort of like write that on your notebook.
A week. And I mean, that particular band was just two of my friends, and we just wanted to hang out, you know? And so we were hanging out and like writing songs with magnetic poetry and stuff. It was ridiculous, but a lot of fun.
And when did you like hit on like, you know, kind of going down the road that you're going down now? Like, when did you start, you know, writing your own songs and playing guitar and doing all that?
In high school.
High school.
Yeah. I mean, actually, I wanted to be in a band. I knew I wanted to be in a band. This was before my band with my girlfriends. But, and I think this was freshman year of high school. And this guy, Pat, I knew he was a great guitar player. And I knew he was starting a band. And I said, I want to sing in the band. And he said, okay, you have to sing, I can't remember, that Led Zeppelin line. Like, whoa, whoa, whoa. That part. So I had to sing him that whole line a cappella, and that was my audition. And I got in. And so that was, and then I started like singing, like we sang like Eric Clapton songs. They were a jam band, and then like played percussion and then I started taking guitar lessons on the side, not like telling anyone because I sucked and I didn't want to suck. So
nobody wants to suck.
That's true.
For some it's unavoidable.
Right.
But clearly, that was not your path.
Yeah.
So you took a lot of lessons?
No, I took lessons. This guy, Danny Flanagan, who's a songwriter and great songwriter in Louisville, he gave me lessons for, I think, maybe a month or two. But then by that point, I was like just bringing in songs that I wanted to learn. He would like listen to them and then figure them out. And then I realized, oh, I can do that too. Like I can just learn them by ear.
I was a terrible guitar student. Which is funny because I love it now. I take the odd lesson now, or mostly what I just find stuff on YouTube.
Yeah.
You know, you can find anybody explaining anything. Do you sort of still like woodshed your chops in any way? I mean, I don't want to.
I don't know if you call what I have chops exactly.
Well, I mean, I know you eventually went to music school, right?
Well, not really. No, I was in.
I have been missing
for college,
I thought maybe for college.
I was just in the arts and sciences program at NYU, but I started learning production stuff when I worked in studios. Yeah, I never really was schooled in the music theory of anything.
And did you have a Branson, Missouri connection?
I did. I lived there in middle school.
And would that have been? When country music sort of came on your radar?
Oh, yeah. I mean,
What is Branson like? I've never actually been to Branson.
Oh, you have to go. I mean,
it's like the Las Vegas of country or something, right?
Well, in Branson, they call it Nash Vegas. But I don't know if anyone... Yeah. It was a crazy place to live. I mean, it was a tourist destination, and they would bus in loads of mostly 60 and older folks, and they would have shows that started at like 8 in the morning.
Wow.
Crazy.
That's not rock and roll town.
No. No, and there were, you know, there were a bunch of like novelty acts, like the Bald Knobbers, and they would paint their teeth black, you know, and they were, and you know, they would have teeth like hay in their teeth and perform
like
without shoes. Exactly.
Yeah,
yeah. And I loved Hee Haw as a kid. I loved it. But you know, Ray Stevens had a theater there when I was there. The Oak Ridge Boys had a theater there. Who else? I know that Johnny Cash and Loretta Lynn, I think, both had theaters in Branson at some point, but that was not when I was there. I think
right.
It was before I got there.
Right, right.
But I mean, it was a cool experience. I mean, there were performers there. You know, I lived near this place called Silver Dollar City, and it's sort of like a throwback theme park where, you know, you have your sort of like Dollywood. Have you ever been to Dollywood?
I've never been, but
okay. Well, you can imagine what it's like. Yeah. And that was pretty much what Silver Dollar City was like, you know, but people would be playing music all the time there. There would be, in fact, my friend Autumn, her dad, his job was playing guitar all day long, sitting on a front porch with the shoes off, probably, you know, because that was the MO of the
park.
That
was the shtick.
Yeah.
Ah,
yeah.
So did some of that rub off on you as a kid?
Oh, sure. I'm sure it did. Yeah. I think that stuff always pops up like much later, because when you're in that part of life, you're resisting it,
right?
You know, you're like,
right,
I'm not. Once, I don't listen to that. I listen to the gin blossoms.
Thing. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Totally. I get it. Yeah. Where I grew up, it was like, you know, Santa Barbara in the 70s and 80s, and it was like hippies and stuff. I hated it. Hated it. It took me years to be able to like listen to a Grateful Dead record and like without judgment.
Yeah.
You know, and like
yeah.
be open to it.
Yeah.
Know?
And how do you feel now?
I mean, I like a couple of them. It's not so much my thing, but you know, there's, you know, I like the ones that people like me like, you know, what is it? American
Beauty.
Yes. Mm-hmm. That's the one. What's the one either right before it or after it? Working Man's Dead.
Okay.
That's the one. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Those are good records.
Yeah.
They're cool.
Well, the songs
but when I was
so
a
good.
Kid, I mean, that was so, I was so immersed in that all around me that I just fucking hated
right.
it.
You yeah. Know? You tune it out. It's like a certain frequency. You're like, I'm not going to listen to that.
Yeah.
And I actually felt like that about like bluegrass too. From I mean, when I lived in Louisville, it was all around. But I was
really
yeah. I was it was on the radio. They had like a bluegrass convention every
really?
Year. But I was listening to like Slint and like you know Will Oldham. I was listening to like the punk / indie stuff that was going on because it was really exciting to me that people were making that music. And then I moved to New York, and my roommate was this. Molly, she was this like punk girl from the Northeast, and she loved bluegrass.
Mm.
And so I started listening to it there, and it suddenly took on this whole new meaning.
Right.
And I was in a completely different environment, and you're sort of nostalgic for what you don't have. So
yeah,
it's cool.
Yeah,
it's weird.
Yeah, that's cool.
Weird turn of events, but yeah.
Yeah, it's great to. I love that there's still a bluegrass tradition in mm-hmm. Kentucky. You would think that would just be like dead and gone, but it seems like I've interviewed a few people that grew up there, and that's still like a, you know, part of life. It's
I mean, it's not just Kentucky. I mean, I was driving the other day. We played at Mountain Stage in West Virginia, and I was listening to like the radio stations, and there's some great country music and bluegrass shows, gospel. I mean, and bands I've never heard of. You know, but they're great.
It's such a ripping style.
It is.
I think that's why so many guitar players are drawn to it. Mm-hmm. I was just sitting in my hotel room the other day, like trying to learn all these Tony Rice licks. They're fucking impossible. They just all fall in on each other. It's like it's so hard when you have bad habits or just habits of any kind to go kind of undo them and try to learn something else.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but it's great. I love it. Yeah. It's cool. Okay, so how did you wind up in New York? What brought you to New York? College?
Yeah, I did the thing where I was like, if I want to be a musician, I have to live in New York. I don't know where I got that idea because I'd never been there before, and I only applied to colleges in New York.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So, and the first time I went to New York, I was singing with my choir at Carnegie Hall, and I remember
that's a big gig.
I got in trouble because I walked like many, many blocks down to Greenwich Village because I thought I have go to Greenwich Village. I have to check it out. And I got in trouble, but that's where I ended up going to school. It was NYU down there. So
were you like on a quest to find Phil Oaks or something.
Kind of.
Where are they all hanging out? I was like, wait, I'm
30 years too late.
Yeah. So you're performing, you're going to school, you're playing guitar, writing songs.
Mm-hmm.
How did you wind up making records? What was like your break? Or were you doing it yourself?
I mean, I always did.
I know you have an engineering.
Yeah, I always did it myself. I mean, my friend had a 4-track that I would mess around with in Louisville, and I made a little tape when I was in high school. And thank God it's not available or doesn't exist on the internet, which is awesome.
Not yet. Wait until this comes out.
No.
We're going to be digging it up.
Oh, no. It was great. I mean, it was fun. I had a great time. My mom helped me like fold the inserts and, you know, all that stuff. And I would play little open mics and sell them at those. And
Well, you mentioned your first record coming out on a French label. How did that come about?
Well, so there were a couple
and
of
that's interesting because I've seen that you've toured internationally. And it seems like a lot of, you know, people under the big umbrella of Americana or whatever don't, you know, that people
really
don't get outside the States as much.
Yeah, I feel like nothing of my career makes any sense. Like it's all just sort of all over the place. I made that tape and then I actually went to Nashville with some guys I was playing with in Louisville before I moved to New York because I wanted a demo of some of the newer songs I'd written. And I think some guy had a friend who worked in a club. I don't even remember what the club was. And we recorded 5 songs really quickly after hours at a club in Nashville.
Mm.
And then I took that to New York and I started getting gigs, like walking around, like giving my demos to people to get gigs and stuff.
Right.
But the first album took me a while to make. I was like working in recording studios and doing it at night.
But how did it wind up coming out through a French label?
I feel like it's all like a ping pong ball or like just like a pinball just kind of. Let's see. I made that first record called Dawn's Music. I don't even remember what year. Probably like 2004 or something. And then what happened? I met Suzanne Vega at a songwriters group.
Ooh.
In the Greenwich Village, and she liked my stuff and she asked me to open for her. So I went to Ireland to open for her. Someone saw me play there, invited me to a festival in Paris. I went to Paris and I was like silk screening things myself, you know. And then some guy who had a small label in Toulouse said, hey, I want to put this out. And then
were you just performing just you and a guitar?
Uh-huh.
That kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So who puts your records out now?
Yep Rock is putting out this new
one.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Is that the first time you've worked with them?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Who was doing it up till then?
I've had so many labels along the way. The last album came out on Western Vinyl. And then I've also worked with Cooking Vinyl and Fargo and the other one. Touchtones? Or no, that's the publishing.
Too many labels
so many.
To even remember the names,
remember.
Dear God.
I know.
I listened to I think you have 3 songs up from your new record up in Spotify, but when is the full length coming out?
Oh, August 10th.
And what's it called?
It's called Meet Me at the River.
Okay, so you're in the full wind-up right now.
Yeah.
Doing the promo hustle.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Are you in the middle of a tour?
I'm kind of just doing a few shows. Like I'm playing LA tonight, and then I'm playing New York in a couple days, and then on the release day, I'm playing in Nashville.
And living in Nashville, where do you sort of, you know, there's so many different sort of sub-genres of country and Americana and all the East Nashville hipster thing and all that sort of stuff floating around from the most mainstream to the least mainstream and veterans and blah, blah, blah.
Uh-huh.
Where do you sort of see yourself slotting into all that?
I mean, I'm definitely attracted to the East Nashville vibe. I don't live there. I live north of town, and I think that's kind of how I feel about the whole scene in general. I'm a little north of it. I'm a little out of it,
right.
But I like to go there to see music and to hang out and everything. But
I'm a little south of it. Anyway, I'm sorry.
Yeah, I don't mean to sound like I'm, you know, uppity about it.
Oh,
it just
no,
happens
no,
to be
no,
physically
no.
north.
No, I get it. I get it.
right.
Yeah.
But no, it's a cool community of people. There's so many great musicians living there right now.
Crazy talent level.
Oh, yeah.
It's just off the charts. Every time I've made 2 records in Nashville and worked with some, you know, guys that play on a lot of records and that sort of thing. And it just, it blows my mind. It really makes me feel like, God, we're so lazy in rock music.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Like, I can't believe I've gotten as far as I've gotten in rock and roll. And, yeah. You know, I could have never made it out of Nashville. You know?
I have not. I mean, I've lived there. It'll be 2 years in November, and I have not heard a bad musician anywhere. And I mean, everywhere you go, there's music.
I know.
The airport, they have bands playing. Yeah. So, and there's been stuff that I'm not as into, but
sure.
The level of musicianship is insane.
Yeah, it's bananas. So what, like, what's next for you? You're going to put your record out, big year, touring, all that sort of stuff.
Yeah,
Do you mostly go out by yourself, or do you go do support slots, or just kind of whatever comes
kind up? Kind of, yeah, whatever. I mean, I've been touring with a band. Like, tonight I'm playing with a band. I'm playing with a band the next couple shows. And there's a bunch of people from, friends of mine from Kentucky, who have been playing, backing me up for, like, the past 2 months on shows here and there. So
what's that like when you go from working with these, like, super legendary A-list Nashville session cats to, like, your buddies from back home? Are you like, that doesn't sound right, god damn it, listen to the record?
I don't know. I mean, it's a complete,
they're not here, you can throw them under the bus. Come on.
No, it's funny because I really enjoy playing music with my friends. Like, that's what I grew up, that's all. Absolutely. All I knew until this album, like, I did not know ever the experience of playing with complete strangers.
Yeah.
You know, it's a different thing. It's,
totally.
It's more totally. Wham bam, you know, and it's great.
Yeah.
It's very economical. Well, I don't know how economical it is financially, but, you know, time wise, it's great.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, music, I love playing music with my friends. That's
sure. That's the greatest thing.
Yeah.
Well, on that end, would you play us a song?
Yeah.
And by us, I mean me. But of course, I'm really talking about the podcasting community in general.
Sure. This song's called What Will I Do? And it's a little waltz. And I think I'm going to play it because you're interested in Fred Foster and how, you know, my relationship with him. And this particular song, I think, was the song where he kind of switched over to thinking of me as a songwriter. Because at the beginning, when I met with him, he was like, oh, there's this singer girl from New York, and she wants me to pick songs. He thought I wanted him to pick songs for me to sing, you know? So, like, no, I'm a songwriter. I write the songs, you know? So it was this song that I think was the sea change for him. So
cool.
Here we go. What will I do? Where will I go? Only the moon and stars can know. When will it be? Hopefully soon. What will I do? When will I know the time is right? What if I misread the signs? If they don't come through? What will I do? How will I know which way to turn? I want every star that burns to fall into line, point me to my next move. But I can get lost, it's happened before. Spend a year or two off course, be nothing new. Ooh, what will I do? How will I know which way to turn? I want every star that burns to fall into line, point me to my next move. Now that I know I want something, scared what's in store for me if I jump open arm into the blue. What if I do? What if I do? What if I do? So what if I do?
All right, that was Dawn Landis on Walking the Floor doing a beautiful acoustic version of her song, What Will I Do, from her latest record, Meet Me at the River. Get on over to walkingthefloor.com. I'm going to put links up so you can find out exactly where Dawn's playing, what's happening, listen to some of her music, and check out some of the things that we talked about. Walkingthefloor.com. Go get it. Okay, thanks again to Fender Play for all their support. If any of you listeners are interested in learning to play guitar without the usual hurdles, check out a free trial of Fender Play by visiting fender.com/walkingthefloor. That's it for this week, kids. Adios, amigos!